We hear an enormous amount about neuroplasticity today, and we think we know a lot about it too, so much so that many of us consider ourselves lay neuroscientists of sorts. But the truth is, neuroscience, that ability of the brain to change physiologically and functionally as a result of stimulation, is really a new concept for the modern human. You know, back in 1957, for example, before there was even a word for such a thing, that was an era where we thought of brains as unchangeable. And in that year, 57, a grade one student from Ontario, Canada, called Barbara, overheard a conversation that would profoundly change the way she thought of herself and the way we now think about our brain's ability to change. The conversation was between her mother and a teacher. Author Barbara Arrowsmith-Young's profound story stems and will start in that day. What did you overhear, Barbara?
I overheard my grade one teacher tell my mother that I had a mental block. And as you noted, the term learning disability or learning difficulty did not exist at that time. So being very literal and very concrete, because that was part of my learning difficulty, I didn't comprehend, I actually thought I had a wooden cube in my head that made learning really difficult. So I was told in grade one, not to expect much of myself, that I had limitations because the brain was fixed. That was a view at the time, that I had to accept my limitations and learn to live within them. I was told that schooling would always be a struggle and not to expect that I would really go beyond high school.
Your childhood was extraordinarily challenging for that reason, Barbara. And I've read about your story before, but you've become the best-selling author of the book The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. You went on to defy all expectations, including your own. But let's sit in that childhood, Barbara, for a moment or two. When you heard the teacher talk about learning blocks and you imagined literally this block in your brain, at that stage you were already quite aware that there was something unusual going on with your thinking. Tell us about your relationship to space, clocks, mm-hmm. and your environment at that time and why you knew there was something up.
Well, I knew there was actually problems before I started in school. I was incredibly uncoordinated. I didn't know where the left side of my body was in space. I didn't know at that time it was my brain, but later on I was to learn that the part of my brain that registers sensation on the left side of the body was not functioning. So my mother later shared with me that she thought I would be dead by the age of five because I was so uncoordinated. We spent time in emergency rooms because I would, you know, trip and fall and misjudge where I was relative, you know, to the car, relative to a door frame. I ended up being banged and bruised and battered, at my own hands in a sense. I was actually a danger to myself physically. So that was prior to school. And then coming to school, that was where the other pieces, the comprehension, you know, all the things that you're supposed to learn in year one were a struggle. I struggled to learn how to read, how to write. I wrote everything backwards. I read words backwards or even upside down. You gave me two numbers to add. I'd pick the numbers at random and add them in any sequence and not necessarily the same sequence twice. And so my teacher in year one was very, very confused. And in fact, I got the strap in that first year of school because I think she thought I was doing these things willfully. Because I wrote backwards, I smeared the print and I was anxious, so my hand was sweaty. So my notebooks were a mess. They were unintelligible. And I really think she was at her wit's end. I would have meltdowns in grade one and just, you know, cry inconsolably. And the teacher would have to dismiss all the students, send them out for early recess because she couldn't handle my meltdown. And they would all be standing there looking back in through the classroom window at me, which was incredibly embarrassing. But I had so much despair. Children often starting school are excited about learning. You know, they kind of skip into the classroom. I walked out the door of my house and the school was right across the street every morning with fear and anxiety because I knew I'd be met with things that were just really hard. I could see other children learning and I just couldn't do what they were doing. I ended up in the turtle reading group and I knew that wasn't the reading group one wanted to be in because we were struggling and I was probably struggling the most.
In year eight, you woke up in a state of despair. You said you'd really reached the end of your rope.
I had. It was such a struggle getting through elementary school. I couldn't imagine high school. And certainly in Ontario, high school starts at grade 9. And this is where you have multiple subjects, different teachers. It was so hard for me to process and understand my world with just one teacher trying to impart knowledge. And I just felt I couldn't do it and saw no possibility, no future. And it was a mixed blessing having the learning difficulty that I had. It's what drove me to the despair to just want to end my life, but also because I didn't really comprehend the instructions of how one went about doing that. I thought you did something, you went to bed, and you didn't wake up the next morning. Well, I woke up the next morning, and instead of being happy that I was still here on this earth, it was another opportunity to berate myself. I couldn't even get that right. But I felt, okay, I'm here. I have no choice. I'm going to have to go to high school, and I'm just going to have to try harder and, you know, that heroic effort you talked about.
Barbara, you speak about the role of your father in your life and what he taught you about dealing with problems. This brave adventure that you were on for your teen years, you know, it's extraordinary reading your book, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain. It's extraordinary hearing you speak because the depth of your difficulty was enormous, and yet there was hope there for you. And there's something that your father said to you about problems that I'd love you to repeat.
Yes, I was very, very blessed in both of my parents. And my father, he was an inventor. He was a scientist. He had a number of patents for things that he had created. And he had this belief that if there's a problem that exists and there's no solution out there, he said, it's your responsibility to go out and hunt for a solution. And then he said something that I've held dear to my heart. He said, if the rest of the world says you can't do it, he said, don't be limited by conventional wisdom. He said, this is how science goes forward. And I held that very dear. I had no idea how I was going to overcome these difficulties, but I felt that I was set on a quest, you know, to find a solution. And it was always there in the forefront of my mind that there had to be a better way to address learning difficulties rather than compensate, rather than spend so much energy working around the difficulty and trying to get, you know, other functions to take over for that difficulty, which really weren't designed to do that job. And that's how I had spent my life. And I just had to believe there was a better way.
One of the things that you knew you needed to do in order to find out what the problem actually was work that out. At this stage, it's 1977. Somehow, through sheer force of will, you've got yourself into university. You're now studying psychology, and you're curious still to find out what is the nature of what's going on with your learning. And that's when, at the age of 25, you made a profound discovery in meeting someone who mirrored what you had. Tell us about the soldier that you met.
Yes. Well, I met this soldier on the pages of a book, and it was a book that changed my life. And it was written by Alexander Luria, who was a brilliant Russian neuropsychologist. And in fact, I dedicate my book to Luria because I wouldn't be here sitting in the studio today without Luria's work. He really saved my life because I was, again, at a point of despair. I was working 20 hours a day, sleeping 4 hours a night, 7 days a week, just to tread water at university. Mm-hmm. And again, I saw no future for myself. And this time, I would have got the instructions right. I knew what I needed to do. And then somebody handed me this book. So I will remember that day in August of 1977. It was The Man with the Shattered World was the title of the book. And it was the story of Leo Vyazetsky, who was a Russian soldier who in 1943 at the Battle of Smolensk had a wound to his brain in World War II. And this man kept a journal. And so a lot of this book was Leo Vyazetsky's journal describing his experience after that wound. And then Lurius, the neuropsychologist, would describe what was going on in the brain. And as I read this man's journal, I thought, he's living my life, you know, several decades earlier, halfway around the world. We were using exactly the same language in both of our journals. I talked about living in a fog. He talked about living in a fog. We both described how meaning was ephemeral. It would just disappear in a mist, that we couldn't hold on to it. He had been able to tell time before his injury. After the injury, he couldn't read an analog clock. Before the injury, he'd been studying mathematics and doing very well. Afterwards, he couldn't understand fractions, relationships, greater than, less than, bigger than, smaller than, I'd never been able to address or understand those relationships. So now I knew it was my brain. Like, and you have to know what the problem is before you can solve it. So now I knew there was some problem. I knew I didn't have a bullet in my brain. But since birth, that part of my brain hadn't been working.
At this stage, I'm assuming we didn't have the technology that allows us to scan the brain and see what's going on inside it the way that we do now. You were left very much to your own devices. And it strikes me as a bit of a miracle that once you had worked out that there was something going on in your brain that was similar to Sezevsky, you then decided there was a way you could invent some exercises to help your brain. Now, what was the missing link in there? Whose research was it that allowed you to work
that out? It was the research of Mark Rosenzweig, and he was a psychologist at Berkeley in California. And he was looking at this concept of neuroplasticity, which, simply put, means that our brain is actually capable of change and capable of change across our lifespan with appropriate stimulation, experience, learning. And I thought he was looking at rats and finding that their brains changed as a result of stimulation. And I thought, if rats have neuroplasticity, surely humans must have neuroplasticity.
You weren't using the word neuroplasticity at that moment, though, were you? Was it just starting to be talked about then?
It was certainly, I mean, Rosenzweig talked about it in his work, absolutely. And it just made sense that we must have that, even though the people I talked to, you know, my professors at school at that point at university were saying, first of all, they said learning disabilities or learning difficulties have nothing to do with the brain. I'm not sure what they thought they had to do with. And then they said, and even if they did, we know the brain's fixed, so you can't do anything about it. And I thought, I'm desperate. I have no idea if this is going to work, but what do I have to lose but time? And I couldn't tell time. So I figured it was worth taking a chance. And again, I was in despair.
What was the exercise that you first set for yourself?
Actually, it was clocks. And, you know, people wonder, was it just that I wanted to get better at telling time? No, that wasn't my goal. I mean, certainly I did. I can now read an analog clock, which I couldn't before. But the idea is I wanted to find an activity that forced my brain to process relationships.
Because you knew, didn't you?
Yes. I knew that's what I couldn't do. I couldn't make, like, even cause and effect, why things happened. I did not understand. So I knew from Luria's work, and it was really, I mean, if you look at my books of Luria, there are multiple colors. I'm drawing pictures, like trying to understand what he's saying. But I got this sense that if I could get my brain to process relationships and get it really accurate and more efficient, maybe I could change it. And the best way I could figure was clocks, because it is a relationship between the hour hand and minute hand. But what I found is I had to keep making them more complex. So the first was two hands, then I added a third hand, and that was great. Now I could read a clock with an hour, minute, second, but I wasn't feeling cognitive change. It was at the four-hand clock. I added a fourth hand where I was forcing my brain to process four relationships simultaneously, that my world changed and I knew there was human neuroplasticity.
I love hearing about the moment when you realized there had been a change, that it wasn't all for naught. And you speak about your longing, your difficulty with abstract thought, but your longing to understand philosophy. Mm-hmm. Could you talk to us about that moment when you realized?
Yes. I mean, philosophy is very conceptually dense and it had always fascinated me, but always been impossible. I mean, I could read the words, but I couldn't comprehend. So I decided after I saw this change where I could understand what people were saying, I could listen to documentaries and understand, which I'd never been able to do before, I thought, let me test myself. And I had access to a philosophy library. So I pulled a book off the shelf and I opened it at a page at random and I read it and I understood it, which had never happened before. I mean, before even any kind of text, unless it was like simple narrative, I would read that page 5, 10, 15 times. And what Luria had talked about is you're constantly hypothesizing what meaning is, but you can never verify meaning. So you're walking around in a state of uncertainty, a cloud of unknowing. Now I could read this page and I could actually understand it the first time I read it. But I thought, maybe this was a really simple book. Maybe by accident I picked something really easy. So I pulled another book off, opened it randomly, read it, understood it. By the time I was finished, I had 100 books piled up around me, and I had been able to read a page in each book and understand. And it's so much more efficient and exciting if you can actually understand, you know, what you're reading and then build on that. It was like I wanted to go into the library and like read every single book that was in that library. And actually, I kind of grieved a little bit too because I was now, I think, 26 at this point. And I thought all those years of education where I just memorized and all that wealth of knowledge and information that I had never understood. I had a hunger for learning.
Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, the author of the best-selling The Woman Who Changed Her Brain, is also the founder of the Arrowsmith School. Barbara, your suffering has been put to good use. At what point, though, for you personally, before we talk about the school that you founded and the learning programs that now change the lives of other young people who are suffering from similarly difficult learning disabilities or learning blocks or whatever it is that we want to call them, at what point were you able to cultivate a voice of kindness for yourself? You lived all of your life with the deep shame of thinking there was something wrong with you.
It took a lot of years. It did not come quickly or easily. Naively, I thought when I did this work that I changed my brain. I can now do things that I couldn't do before. And all of that, you know, problems with self-esteem, depression, anxiety would just drop away. But I was not correct about that. And it was because I'd had 25, 26 years of living, like in grade one, I started to think I was bad and I was stupid. And that lived inside of me. So it took a number of years working therapeutically with good therapists that helped address the anxiety and the depression. But now I could benefit from therapy. I mean, before, I had no capacity for insight because if you can't see relationships, cause and effect, I couldn't make those kind of connections to understand this is why this happened. So it was several years, and there's still that little girl that lives in me somewhere that occasionally pops out thinking, oh my gosh, I can't do this. And, you know, I chat with her and say, well, yes, we can. We're in a different place, and we go forward. But I think that's why I'm so passionate about getting this work into year one. So these individuals don't have to have all these years of struggle that I did, where all of the negative self-talk, negative emotions build up.
You believe that cognitive exercises should be a standard part of education. At the moment, they are accessible through things like the learning of Norman Doidge or, you know, through the Arrowsmith School itself and the Arrowsmith program. But you believe they should be more standard and more available. How would that look?
Well, interestingly, that was the end of my book in 2012, and now I've done an updated, revised version with what's happened over the last 4 years. And I always thought I was an optimistic person, but when I wrote that vision, exactly as you said, that every child stepping into year one, part of the day they do cognitive programs, part of the day they learn curriculum because we learn with our brain. And I thought, I will not see this in my lifetime. Well, there are now three schools, two in the United States, and there was one that trialed this in Australia that put one of my cognitive programs in their grade one class, and we got remarkable results. The students on writing tests outperformed all of the other students in the other classes, even the gifted class. They outperformed the gifted class over the course of a year on writing measures, standardized writing measures. In another school, they outperformed the students in reading comprehension, reading. So to me, the power is if we can change the brain, which is fundamentally how we learn and what we learn with, the learning just goes forward and it becomes easy and it's actually joyful and pleasurable. I mean, my education, there was no joy in any of my educational experience. There should be joy in learning, and this allows that possibility.
Barbara, how do you find joy today?
That's a really interesting question. I love gardening. So I'm a passionate gardener. And to me, gardening is like art in slow motion and it's very meditative. And another way I find joy is meeting the students have been impacted by this work. I mean, that's my favorite part of my job is where I get to visit schools. So actually, I'm visiting two schools in Melbourne that offer the program, and I get to talk to the students and hear their stories. And that that fills my heart with joy.
I'll give you dates and information about those speaking events in just a moment. But Barbara, while I still have you here in person, tell me, what are the questions that you get asked the most by parents in your travels throughout the world? What is it that they're most desperate to know?
I think they're most desperate to know is this program going to benefit their child? You know, will it make a difference in their child's life? Because they're coming, you know, seeing their children struggle. And they know that we live in a pretty complex world. And maybe there can be accommodations in school to help the child get through school. But as one parent said, school is just a metaphor for life. I mean, these problems don't end at the classroom door. So their real anxiety is what's going to happen, you know, even if they get through school, once they go out into the world and there's nobody there compensating for them or helping them work around their difficulties. And I would say that's the main question that I get. And I mean, I point to the research. Mm. I point to, you know, the people that have been through the program. I mean, I'm really excited. We're actually doing imaging research now at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We're doing imaging research at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, in Illinois. And we're actually seeing now the changes in the brains of the students going through this program that match with the cognitive changes and the academic changes that we're seeing. So it does work, and it's very profound.
Here in front of me, I see an enormously capable, learned woman. Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, do you still need, in your everyday life, do you still need additional support or additional compensation to sort of be able to do things like read maps, read clocks, or get through your day?
None, absolutely none. I mean, I've traveled the world now multiple times, you know, talking about my work. I don't get lost, which is wonderful. Yeah. You know, I can build IKEA bookcases, which is wonderful. Those words, some assembly required, don't strike fear into my heart. And I can have this conversation. I would not have been able to have this conversation with you before. I would not have understood what you were asking me. I would have felt ashamed. I would have smiled. There would be no dialogue. I was not able to engage in human discourse, which is really tragic. No individual should feel isolated from human discourse.
Well, I'm so glad we've been able to talk today.
Thank you.
Barbara Arrowsmith-Young's book, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain, has just been updated, 2016 edition. We mentioned before that Barbara's here to speak in Melbourne. Those dates, it's tonight, Tuesday, February the 28th at Holy Trinity Federated Schools. It starts at 7 p.m. Also tomorrow night, the Oakley Grammar School, A Personal Journey into the World of the Brain. The talk will start at 5:30. And on Thursday, a third opportunity to hear Barbara speak, Australian Education Union. You can find out all details from Barbara's website, which is barbaraarrowsmithyoung.com.